Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining our September Coalition call. I hope this finds everyone still healthy and safe. Before we get started, if everyone can mute their phones so we don't have any background noise during our presentations today, that would be wonderful. So thank you. I hope our call gives you some insight into some of the ways localities and organizations are innovating and leading on the issue of going back to school during the COVID-19 pandemic, with the hopes of giving you strategies to replicate certain approaches in your own communities. As we welcome students and adults back to school, whether that be in person, virtually, or through a hybrid learning experience, education in the time of a long-term global pandemic is a very new experience. You face the layered impact of school closures, the pandemic, racial inequities amplified by nationwide mobilization, and more. It is easy to get lost in the ever-changing flow of the day-to-day. Whether educating through technology or in your own home, this is the time to re-envision education. In order for young people to engage and learn, we need to create environments that promote a positive sense of well-being and healthy connections between peers and adults. As we navigate the pandemic's fallout among our children, we need more than ever to make social-emotional learning, or SEL, a cornerstone of our local education systems, as well as America's education system. SEL is a proven approach to teaching students how to identify and process emotions, build relationships, work in groups, and resolve conflicts. They role play, learn peer meditation skills, and how to set personal goals, all of which help foster resilience. Extensive research demonstrates how SEL increases school attendance and participation, with strong evidence for improved academic performance and increased positive social behavior. I wanted to share a few points from the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, also known as CASEL, around strategies for the unique environment we all are in. First, they say create a foundation for social emotional learning. Second, attend to well-being and mutual support among adults. Third, promote social emotional learning for young people. And fourth, reflect on how things are going and adjust as you learn. I think we all can relate. We are building the plane while flying it in most situations. But it's not just students who need the emotional tools and support to thrive during these uncertain times. It's also our teachers, our education support professionals, parents, and family support systems. We all know that a strong two-way communication between families and schools is essential to success. That means to promote SEL, we'll need to work closely to learn from and support one another in creating the environments that can support students socially and emotionally, which includes helping families address their own stresses, anxieties, and asking families to inform schools and the district approaches to social-emotional learning. All educators, community partners, parents, and others who touch the lives of young people are also experiencing disruption in their lives caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, which may result in increased stress, anxiety, uncertainty, and feeling overwhelmed. We need to pay close attention to their social-emotional needs as well in order to be the community of adults who best serve our young people. One of the most valuable sources of information about what is or isn't working will come directly from our students, our families, and our wider community of stakeholders. That is why today's topic is so important. We have a great slate of speakers today. You'll be hearing from representatives from New York City Department of Education, Chicago Public Schools, Washington, D.C.'s Department of Behavioral Health, and Mental Health America, who will walk you through some of the innovative programming they have created to help our students, teachers, education support professionals, and families weather the COVID-19 pandemic. We will get started today with Elizabeth Strantzel, who serves as the Director of Policy at the Division of School, Climate, and Wellness in New York City's Department of Education. Elizabeth will be discussing the City of New York's Bridge to School plan. For some quick background, just so you know, New York City is doing a hybrid learning structure of in-person and virtual classes, just so you understand the current learning environment we are instituting here in the city. Bridge to School is a citywide initiative for 2020 and 2021 school year focused on the social-emotional well-being of students and adults in order to create a safe, supportive learning environment that confronts the trauma caused by the COVID-19 crisis. I don't want to steal Elizabeth's thunder, So Elizabeth, if you hit the star button twice, your line will be unmuted and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Walt, and good afternoon, colleagues. I'm really honored to be here representing the Division of School Climate and Wellness under the leadership of Deputy Chancellor LaShawn Robinson, and look forward to learning alongside you today. I'm going to begin talking about our Bridge to School plan, and we'll cover kind of how it came to be, what it includes, and what some of our challenges were along the way. So like many of you, all of you, when New York City first switched to remote learning, we immediately worked to support schools with resources around social emotional learning and wellness, because we wanted to continue the foundational work that we were already doing in schools through our supportive environment framework and with social emotional learning programs like Sanford Harmony, RULER, and restorative practices that our city had invested in significantly. We wanted to keep the momentum, and we wanted to care for students and families as they were going through unprecedented levels of stress and trauma. And we were also operating regional enrichment centers, or REC sites as we called them, for children of essential workers. So our immediate focus was just to provide supports there and sustain those spaces. But once we had those set up, pretty early into the spring, we pivoted to planning for reopening and thinking about how can we ensure that we're meeting the needs of students, families, and educators when we come back. What should our preparation look like from April to September? And what does school reopening look like? So what are the big ideas of what we want to see, down to the very granular, like what actually happens on day one? So my daughter will have her first in-person day later this week, and I want her classroom teacher to be prepared to welcome her with tools and resources to really care for her social and emotional needs. And I want that for all of our 1.1 million students. So to get there, we knew that we had to do a combination of things. So first, through generous private donations, we were able to partner with a program at the University of Chicago called TREP, which is the Trauma Responsive Educational Practices Project. And we were able to offer trauma-informed care, healing-centered professional learning for our school leaders and staff. So we trained over 1,600 school and district leaders this summer, and so far this fall have already trained over 40,000 school-based staff in trauma-informed care and healing-centered work. And it was really important for us to do that first so that adults had the knowledge and orientation to approach the work when we came back. And then from there, we created the Bridge to School plan, which I'll go over today. And that was really a means to put that learning and that orientation into practice. We wanted schools to have a very practical, age-appropriate guide so that they could support adult needs and student needs as early as day one and then throughout the year. So I know that Walt shared the document in advance. It's probably helpful to have it up if you're able to as we go through. I'm going to call out page numbers in a couple different sections and take you through some of the highlights, and you can follow along. So what is it? What's included? So the Bridge to School plan is intended as a resource guide to give school leaders and school staff really practical strategies, resources, and ideas for how to care for the wellness of adults and students upon reopening. So this is our response to the outcry of feedback and advocacy of so many stakeholders saying, you have to prioritize social emotional wellness. We can't return to school like nothing happened. Our staff and students need support. What are we going to do? So big picture, the Bridge to School plan is organized around two key themes, which are community and resilience. Community is because everyone plays a role in this work. This is not just the work of a school leader or a counselor. Literally every single person who interacts with students, from safety, paraprofessionals, cafeteria staff, CBO partners, we wanted every single person to see themselves in the work and to feel supported. And not only is it everyone's work, but we're also stronger when we're together. And the way that we will thrive is doing the work together. So anchoring the resource and community was really important to us. And the theme of resilience was also really important because of its alignment to our anti-racist values. So we found a tendency in trauma conversations, even people with good intentions, viewing students through a deficit lens or overemphasizing what happened to people as opposed to who they are. And while it's important to acknowledge the lived experiences of our communities and to support that, a focus on resilience also allows us to acknowledge the many strengths and assets that individuals bring to the healing space. So that's true for students and educators. So once we landed on those themes, we then worked to build out resources for adults and students of all grade levels that would build on our trauma-informed work and would elevate a lot of the SELF practices we already had in place, with those community and resilience as really our anchors. So the document itself is long and too much to cover the entire thing on this call, but I'm going to highlight a few key things, and then you can dig into it offline. So the first thing I want to highlight is on page 6, and that's the proactive family and community engagement section. So again, thinking of community, we know that we need to do this work with our families. And rather than kick off the year with formal social emotional assessments or assumptions about how children may have experienced the last school year, we're encouraging schools to do family outreach as a means to gather information about what students may need so that we can plan our day one, week one, month one support accordingly and really personalize that. We know that at one time, Elmhurst, Queens was the epicenter of the pandemic in the nation, and their needs are more significant than other communities. So schools will really have to take this resource and use family engagement and other strategies to personalize their support plan. So after that section, we move into our social and emotional learning section. So we have on page 9 some considerations for different types of learning environments, blended, remote, in person, so that no matter how students are learning, social emotional wellness is still central to the model, and that's happening regardless. And then on page 10, we have a section that's just for adult SELF. So this is really important. Walt talked about this at the beginning. I think we're all grappling with this work. We know that adults not only lived through the same last year that we did, but they're juggling their own needs, their own families, and their students in the class. So we really wanted to start there and offer strategies for school staff and school leaders to do community building and resilience work with the adults. Then if you go down a little bit further on page 11, you get into the age-specific section. So we organized the resource into early childhood, K through 5, middle school, and high school. And the activities are different, but structurally, those sections are the exact same. So you have ideas, day one ideas for staff, for morning, middle, end of day. Then you have day one ideas for students, morning, middle, end of day. And then you have ongoing activity ideas. That can be the first few weeks throughout the year. And actually, just one thing I want to point out, for the day one activity for staff, as well as for each of the student groups, we did the same, welcome and reflection. We structured that activity the same way and then just differentiated it based on age. And we did that because we wanted to have a really strong anchor on day one and to tie it directly to the summer training work that we did. So in the TREP trauma-informed series, they talk a lot about the effectiveness of writing and journaling exercises as a technique. So we incorporated that. And then we pulled over some questioning and discussion techniques that were recommended by Dr. Sean Jinwright, who's also a leader in the field. So we pulled those together to just kind of standardize that and really solidify day one. And just as a point of context, schools have full discretion to use what works for them and what doesn't work. We know that schools are approaching this school year with vastly different backgrounds in terms of what they've already done with SEL or what their orientation is. So there's nothing mandatory or compliance-based in the Bridge to School plan. It's a resource, and we hope that schools use it as it works for them. So just moving down a little more, after each of those age-specific sections, we have some supporting sections. So we have a stakeholder engagement section on page 24. That really calls out how schools can leverage other stakeholders in the work. How are you using students, families, community-based organizations, and more? Because this isn't just the job of school staff. And there are a lot of stakeholders with resources and knowledge and insight and passion for the work that will make it stronger if they're engaged. And then following that, it goes into looking ahead. So we know that reopening needs to look different than before. We also know that this work needs to continue throughout the year. This work is getting a lot of national attention because of COVID and instances of racial injustice, but those of us that are passionate about SEL and mental health have known this work was important for a very long time, and we know that it needs to outlast the first 2 weeks of school. So on page 27, we share strategies and resources for how to extend this work throughout the year, and that even includes a section on activities for families. So again, you know, what does this look like early childhood versus K through 12? What are internal resources within the DOE that you can leverage? What are external sites that are valuable as well? And then we close the document with some additional supporting resources from TREP, who's our partner at the University of Chicago. So they have handouts that staff can use, info guides, you know, tip sheets, et cetera. They have a lot of really valuable information that we didn't want to get lost in the training. We wanted to really carry that through to the year, so we included that there. I know it's a lot of information to cover. You'll likely need to unpack it after the call, but hopefully that run through at least gives you an idea of the big picture of what's in the document and how we see schools using it. I'm going to transition to talking about some of our challenges, but please feel free to ask questions about anything that's in there or anything that's coming up actually during the Q&A. So as far as challenges, overall, we've received very positive feedback from the field, from schools, and from our borough staff that support schools. And we're finding that schools are doing what we expected them to do, which is taking what works for them and adapting it to meet their needs. One thing, I don't know if I would call it a challenge, more so a consideration that we had during development was volume. So we wanted to strike the right balance of enough information and resources customized by age without overwhelming people. And we went back and forth about that a lot. I think some people are still feel like it's too much. Others are like, no, it's just right. This is really great. We tried to use the structural format of the resource to kind of offset what was a lot of content, but that's always a challenge. It's like, how much do you put in and what do you put in? Another consideration that impacted the final product that was at times challenging was our partnership with the legal department. So making sure that we're not misrepresenting any vendor content as our own. So everything that was in there had to be entirely DOE homegrown or had to link exclusively, you know, to an external vendor site to make it clear that that was vendor content. And this actually is very tricky in the field of SEL because we borrow a lot of ideas from each other. There's a lot of like shared concepts or activities for circles or for you know, exercises with kids that feel like, oh yeah, everybody does that. Everyone knows that. But if you're thinking of creating something similar for your district, that's definitely a consideration that you'd want to think about. And then one final consideration was just related to existing practices. So with all of these support things, beginning as early as the trauma training and to now the Bridge to School plan, we wanted schools to see how the work that they were already doing fit in. So we wanted them to understand that, for example, if you're doing restorative circles to establish healthy relationships, that's a form of trauma-informed care. Or if you're using health education lessons to build self-management or self-regulation skills, then you're doing trauma-informed care. So a suggestion I would have if you're looking to do this work in your own district or organization would be to build on your existing infrastructure and programming so that everyone has an access point. And also aligning to your values, making sure that your values around equity or anti-racism or whatever they are, that those are present and viable in the space. That'll really help increase buy-in and also staying power so that communities see, oh yeah, this might have a different lens when I consider, you know, trauma-informed care or healing-centered, but what this resonates with what I've been doing, and I have some skills and experiences to bring to the table. And just one last thing before we transition to Q&A, I want to acknowledge that the creation of this and also the trauma work that we did over the summer was a hugely collaborative effort with many different DOE and non-DOE stakeholders. We actually got connected to the trauma program through an advocate group that works with a lot of our schools. For example, a lot of the ideas around community came from different community-based organizations, advocates, and student partners. So although this was organized and put out through our division, there were many hands making this happen, and we're really grateful for that partnership and think it's a much stronger product. Because it was really very collaborative in the development. So I think that's probably all for my time. We can switch to question and answer if anyone has it. I'd be happy to discuss further.
Great. Thank you, Elizabeth, for that great presentation. If you have a question on the line, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Give folks a second. Liz, I have more of a logistics question for you. How did you guys deal with, a lot of the cloudy skies are uncertainty around, you know, what was going to happen, whether it was going to be, we're going to be virtual, in-person, hybrid model. and not to mention just the quick ramp up period. How did you guys deal with that from getting this plan implemented to the plan itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one thing that we were able to do through the generosity of some private donors was allocate procession funding to give schools time to plan over the summer so that they weren't looking at this for the first time on the first day of school. So we were able to offer schools up to 12 hours of procession at each one of our schools so that the leader could designate a staff member to complete like the trauma training in advance, unpack the Bridge School resource in advance, and we created some facilitation guides and tools that they could use like to fill out and help them see the big picture and have a plan so that they weren't coming back on the first day, like, you know, starting from scratch, let's say. So that was one thing that we tried to do. And I think just also being cognizant in the types of activities that we selected, like going back to the point about familiarity and building on systems, like we were intentional about embedding Sanford Harmony and restorative practice activities in the resource so that the lead time wasn't as long, because schools would be like, okay, yeah, I'm kind of familiar with that. Here's a slightly different angle to it, or different context, knowing that I'm looking through a trauma lens. But, I, you know, it doesn't take me as long to get up to speed on that as something I had never seen before. So those, at the school level, those were a few things that we tried to do. And I think at the district and central level, like we committed to this idea pretty early and have been working on this since like the end of April, beginning of May, and really had to maintain a narrow focus on like, these are the things that we're doing, because we couldn't take on a million projects and get them right. Like we had to commit to a few things that we really believed in deeply and just divert all of our resources there and just be consistent. And that's what we tried to do. So engaging, you know, borough office partners early with this idea, letting them know, like, you know, we didn't tell them a week ago, like we've been talking about this all summer long, so that the folks who are supporting schools in addition to us also had a long runway, and really just stayed consistent on like, we're doing the trauma-informed care professional learning and we're doing the Bridge to School plan. And those are the two things that we focused on.
Great. Anyone on the line have any questions? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. I'll just pause for a second. All right, Liz, one more from my end. This was submitted, and you sort of touched on this a little bit in your remarks, is how important was actually having that pre-existing infrastructure in place when it came to SEL for you guys to act quickly and efficiently?
Yeah, I think that was huge, to be honest. And I think that was huge from a logistical perspective and also an emotional one. So, like we said, staff members experienced the last school year, you know, personally as well as professionally. So their own emotional bandwidth for something new was limited, right? So we had, like, even if centrally we had, you know, thousands of people working to pump out these new resources, which of course we didn't because that's not realistic, but even if we had, that wouldn't have worked for the field because there wouldn't have been an openness to receive that with all the other things they were juggling. So when we initially created all of those resources and supports for rec sites and for schools, all of that was built on the foundation of the Safe and Resilient Kids, or Safe and Resilient NYC package that the district year before. So scaling Sanford Harmony citywide, restorative practices for middle and high school, like that was huge, was being able to leverage that there because people just didn't have the bandwidth for a lot that was new. And then when we worked with TREP over the time, you know, TREP already had a library of professional learning resources that were really high quality, but we worked with them to customize it so that instead of a 4-part series, which is what they already had, we offered a 7-part series, which included 3 additional modules that were DOE created. And the point of that was, again, to leverage and anchor back to what our foundation was. So, like, we created a welcome and middle and closing series that said, hey, If you're doing implicit bias work and you're working with adults on self-awareness, here's how that connects to trauma. If you're doing, you know, restorative practices, circles for middle and high school to build community, here's how you can leverage that here. So at each turn, like that I think was huge for us, and being able to anchor back to that, like in what we first created in our trauma work and then in the Bridge to School plan, is how we were able to get a lot of traction.
Fantastic. At last call for questions for Liz. You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Going once, twice. All right, Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking the time and all the work you guys are doing over at DOE.
Thank you so much.
All right, now for our second presentation today, we are thrilled to have with us Helen Antonopoulos, who serves as the Executive Director of the Office of Social and Emotional Learning at Chicago Public Schools. Helen will be discussing CPS's Successfully Learning at Home This Fall framework, which offers additional mental health interventions and supports grief curriculum, expanded small group trauma interventions, and virtual classroom-based activities for managing stress and anxiety. And with that, I will now turn the call over to Helen to do a deep dive on this. Helen, the floor is yours, and you can mute your line by hitting the star button twice.
Great. Thank you, Walt, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm pleased to be here with you today, and especially to get to learn from old friends and colleagues. It was great to hear Liz and to hear the exciting work that's happening in New York. Similarly, like our friends and colleagues in New York and across the country, our district spent most of our summer, if not all of our summer, planning and preparing for school reopening. In doing that, we developed guidance, and I chuckled when I listened to Liz mentioned about the balancing of volume and just how much information is just the right information. And so in doing that, we worked with partners across the district, internal to CPS as well as external to CPS. And similarly, we focused on what already existed and then tried to work to fill in the gaps. And so we worked with our partners in teaching and learning to emphasize our instructional priorities, emphasizing the rigor that we still expect, but also prioritizing the integration and teaching of social emotional learning as our number one instructional priority for the year. In addition, we emphasize the systems and supports that already existed. Liz mentioned things like our Sanford Harmony or Second Step or PATHS, including restorative practices, things that we have invested time and effort to help deepen in the district as well as continue to grow. And so not introducing too many new things, but going back to those foundational pieces that we know are important for maintaining consistency, both for our students and our staff. What we did a little differently, though, was we started to focus especially on community building. This is, of course, part of our work as the Department of Social Emotional Learning. We do talk a lot about adult SEL. We do engage in restorative practices and promote them across our district. But we wanted to talk about community building with a different lens, taking into consideration the context of our lives currently. And so we talked about how to support both our students and our staff in returning to buildings and creating and recreating those connections and bonds and sources of support. So all of those things were elements of our returning to school guides, whether they were for teachers or for principals. But there was something else that we also were focusing on. While we were preparing for reopening, the district had also been engaged in a new initiative, which is really what I want to focus with our time here today about, which we've referred to as the Healing Centered Project. It was something that we've been working on for nearly a year now with the expectation of launching this fall. And as the school year came closer and COVID continued to be a present variable in our lives, we realized that the Healing Centered Project was something that we had to integrate into school reopening. And so that's what I'd like to share with you today. I think you'll find as I share both our strategies and some of the steps we take, or took rather, that it sounds very, very similar to what New York did. So hopefully you'll also have a deck of just some brief slides to guide through this conversation. And I'll walk through those with you here. So again, as I mentioned, it was really important for us that we have a cohesive vision and work on the foundations of the supports we had already established and practices we had established across the district. But we recognized especially that as our teachers and staff returned to classrooms, which for us was all virtual, we had initially thought to go hybrid, but we are now all virtual. It was really important that we honored that shared commitment to our students, to ourselves, in this idea and value of collective care. Our current context has produced many barriers and challenges and things for us to consider, but we do want to try to focus on that it is an opportunity, both for us to continue to build those relationships that we know are important to the safe and supportive schools that we will hope to achieve, but it's also an opportunity for us to strengthen our resilience, to support recovery, and to foster repair. So for us, becoming healing-centered was more important now than ever. The Healing Center project, as I mentioned, was something that we initiated nearly a year ago, but it was something that was actually a collaborative effort that we intended to hopefully bring to fruition this fall, maybe not as quickly, but certainly it's just as important. The project was a collaboration of several departments within our district, which in itself was a feat. So it included, obviously, our office, as well as people and partners that you may not anticipate. So certainly our teaching and learning office, our Office of Safety and Security, the office that supports our diverse learners, our Title IX office, and especially our Family and Community Engagement office. In addition to these folks, we also included many of our stakeholders. We consulted with students and parents, and especially our CBOs, who were really important and very vocal in how we both reopened schools and how we've envisioned this healing-centered project. Throughout the process, it was important for us that we align to our current values, something I also heard Liz mention. And as you'll see on one of our slides, that included our five-year vision that really focuses on supporting talented and empowered educators, as well as supporting the development of a whole child, and for us to be oriented to a collective impact. We also wanted this healing-centered project and our school reopening plan to be aligned to our equity framework within the district, to advocate for liberatory thinking, inclusive partnerships, equity of resources, and of course, our fair policies and practices. And so those were the two things that we had initially begun to work through and with. However, as COVID became more of a reality, we also started to take that into consideration and how it was impacting our schools and our students, as well as our communities. Our ultimate goal was to transform our district into a more trauma-engaged and culturally responsive school district. Our ask was that we develop a trauma framework for the district. But as you see, we're not calling it the trauma framework, because really what we're focusing on here is the promise of what we want to achieve, which is healing, the resilience, recovery, and repair from the many forms of harm and loss and trauma that our students, staff, administrators, and families experience. But we wanted to do this building on school culture and climate work, building on the trauma trainings we provide, as well as in partnership with other departments across the district. In doing so, we looked at our research. As we know, the impact of trauma is something that has an effect across the lifespan. The ACEs studies tells us that. But we also looked at our plan for creating this trauma framework as a lever for equity. We know that trauma is fundamentally an equity issue, especially in our communities where there's historic disinvestment, and especially in our current context. But we also recognize that there are practices and strategies and tools that help mitigate those impacts of trauma and that promote healing. In particular, those are the safe and stable adult relationships we know are key to supportive school environments. It's also the practices and systems of safe and supportive classroom and school environments, and it's the targeted resources and supports and interventions to address the stressors and experiences of our students and families and staff. And so with those three things in mind, the relationships, environments, and interventions, which are, of course, the core of the supports our office provides, we moved forward with developing a plan and a framework for how we were both going to support our district through these stressful times and into the future, and especially into reopening. In particular, you'll see that there's a visual here, a depiction of the current version of the healing-centered framework. And in the center, you'll notice that there's four green boxes, if you're able to see this. Those are our four key stakeholder groups. And what I want to highlight here for you is that when we first started this project, it was about what are we going to do to support our students through trauma. But then what we realized is it's so much bigger than just trauma, and it's so much more than just our students. And so we eventually came to identify many areas of opportunity for growth in our district, as well as assets that we already had. But in particular, we recognized the needs for support for our staff. And so in one category, we've identified schools as a stakeholder. In this regard, we think about what are the trainings or resources or materials that school staff need in their professional role to support students, to support families, to create safe and supportive relationships and environments. But in a second category, we identify staff as individuals, as people who themselves may be carrying their own loss or stress or trauma, who themselves may be adopting or integrating or internalizing, rather, the experiences of their students. So it's really important that we recognize our staff as individuals as well as their professional role. Of course, our students were also a key stakeholder. They are the center of our work. But without a doubt, none of this work could happen without also the partnership of our families and caregivers and community partners. And so together with that, we've identified key strategies to help with our both school reopening and as our first launch of our healing-centered project. So our first priority is around schools and staff. We wanted to ensure that we're emphasizing the building of supportive relationships, creating those welcoming and predictable learning environments, and fostering those social and emotional skill development, especially critical during times of change and uncertainty, but it's something that we also value at all times. We wanted to emphasize that every interaction we have with our students and families, and including with each other, contributes to our collective success and resilience. To do that, we focused very much of our effort this year in school reopening around training, similar to New York, both around trauma as well as community building workshops for beginning of year. So creating opportunities for reestablishing relationships and senses of sense of security, both for our staff and our students. We have also expanded our trainings for youth mental health first aid to help our communities and schools and our parents recognize students' experiences and stressors and help to connect them to resources of support. And we've also focused on, in addition to, you know, some of those small group interventions, is focusing on things we can do in the classroom, whether virtually or in person, to help students manage some of those stressors and other experiences. So working with one of our local hospitals here, the Lurie Center for Child Resilience, and helping to create sort of plug-and-play strategies that teachers can implement in the classroom to help students navigate through feelings of stress or anxiety or sadness. Again, not exclusively as the only support for students, but as part of a larger menu and a continuum of supports for students. And again, these were based on staff professional roles. In addition to that, we continue to expand our restorative practices. So we have what we call an RP affiliate and leadership program. So it's a series of trainings that our staff can go through in which they earn a certificate and recognition as an RP champion or affiliate. We've also expanded our access to mindful resources, calm practices, which we already do, but again, wanted to take scale. And then similarly, launching a trauma-informed teacher-leader cadre with the ultimate goal eventually in several years of working towards a micro-credentialing of teachers as trauma-informed leaders. So these are some of the steps that we took that we had planned initially as part of this project, but that we've moved up, so to speak, to align with our school reopening and offer additional supports to our staff. We recognize, however, as I mentioned, that they too are experiencing stressors of all forms. And so something new that we piloted this year is what we're calling healing circles for administrators. We've done three cycles of these. We did these over the summer, and they're very much, they were exclusive to principals or assistant principals, people that were in like roles. And it was an opportunity for them to be together with one another and know that they're not alone in their experiences. The feedback was overwhelming. We didn't have people together with their bosses or supervisors or supervisees, but truly the opportunity to just be able to share in a safe space was powerful. And this was something we did in partnership with a community agency. It wasn't something that we ourselves did. Similarly, we wanted to offer a parallel experience for our school staff. And so we'll be piloting a circle of support, trainer of trainers, to be able to train people in buildings to facilitate similar experiences. And lastly, focusing on self-care strategies. Just like we're encouraging mindfulness in our students, we're working with, again, another local university around a series of mindfulness moments at the beginning of the day, at the end of the day, for the next several weeks. As I mentioned, our students, of course, are at the center of all of our work. And so it was really important for us that we help our schools and our students maintain routines. We know that that was important to students' social and emotional needs, but also fostering that SEL skill development. So if they were using a curriculum like Second Step or Sanford Harmony, how can we do that in a virtual space? So we provided resources and guidance on SEL materials that can be done virtually, but especially we wanted to focus on mental health. Looking at our 2019 youth risk behavior data, we noticed that the rates of students who were seriously considering suicide had increased. This is especially true, it's not on this slide, but for our students who are GLBTQ, that rate is nearly 60% who reported seriously considering suicide. And this was before COVID and social unrest. And so it became really urgent for us as we had been planning to address this and support our schools and students in keeping students safe. So we were fortunate enough, you'll see here, to be able to launch the Rainbows and Silver Linings Grief and Trauma Curriculum. Rainbows is a grief curriculum. Silver Linings is a community trauma curriculum. You'll see here that it says 150 schools. That's a fraction of our district. We're not as big as New York, but certainly it is big for us. I'm really pleased to say that since we initiated this, we also were able to secure philanthropic funding so that all of our schools can have staff trained to be able to implement this. And it's across our elementary, our high schools, and our alternative schools. We also noticed a greater need in our middle and high schools for targeted psychotherapy around responding to chronic stress and trauma. And so we've expanded that resource to those schools. And we've especially updated, we're working on updating and providing additional resources for suicide awareness and prevention. Naturally, none of this works or happens in a vacuum. As I mentioned earlier, we do partner with our Office of Family and Community Engagement. They have been great partners in helping us to get feedback and input from families, but also to understand what the needs and experiences of families during this time. And so we've created, as the district has, materials and resources for families. We ourselves have created an SEL website that's public-facing for teachers and staff and families to access with tools and resources and guidance. In particular, though, our FACE office has worked with faith-based community partners to provide youth mentoring. And then internally, we've partnered to create a community agency network. Our goal is to help community partners actually partner with schools and facilitate those partnerships. We've done a community landscape, and where we see that there are schools without a community mental health partner, we are working to connect them to one another so that there's an additional resource both for students and for families. To this point, I want to add it was really important for us to also work with our sister agencies, the Mayor's Office, the Department of Public Health, and the Department of Family and Support Services. They have been key in helping us to identify those community agencies, to support them, and to help them in delivering services to our students. This is just a fraction of our work. It is an extension of the work we have been doing as a district that we prioritize and value greatly, but it is a particular focus during this time and in a particular focus in response to trauma. So as we, you know, just to close out, and I'd rather leave you the time to ask questions, our message has been to continue to focus on building supportive relationships, to continue to create consistent and welcoming learning environments in whatever kind of space that is, and to continue to support schools and staff to foster those SEL skills in students and connect students to mental health resources.
Thanks so much, Helen, for that wonderful presentation. if folks on the line have questions for Helen, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. I'll just hold for a second. Helen, one question that I had in everything you were describing, especially around the work of your teachers and your principals, did you guys have any trouble or any resistance in getting buy-in from these folks? And have you actually seen a lot of the teachers engaged in this effort?
Absolutely. I don't know that we've seen active resistance, right? There may be some people who may not respond or participate. We offer, over the summer, we have historically offered what we call the OSEL Summer Institute. It is a week-long sort of institute of all sorts of professional training, whether it's, you know, SEL curriculum to restorative practices to mental health resources. And we make that available to all staff across the district. On average, we get about 400 to 600 staff. Mind you, this is, you know, all week, and it's not paid. This year, we facilitated a similar institute. We did it virtually, and the response was far more positive and overwhelming. We had more than 2,000 staff that participated in trainings. We also did a special series for those who are sort of discipline leads in schools, recognizing that at times our students' behavior may be misunderstood. And so that was another several thousand people who participated. So we do see an interest, a desire for this. I worry more that we're not able to keep up with all the requests, even though we do have a team and an infrastructure for doing that. So we have rolled out some of these initiatives. As I mentioned, the Rainbows curriculum is currently being facilitated. And so we're waiting to see if all of our schools have accepted the invitation. And so we anticipate that they will. So I wouldn't say that we've had active resistance. I definitely see a desire and interest. I do think, though, as in all things, there are many competing priorities and other things to consider, especially these first couple weeks as our teachers get used to this virtual world and our new practices.
Any questions for Helen? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I see on the slides, there's quite a lot of abbreviations, and I was wondering there, you know, do you have a glossary or something that you could share?
We'll certainly do that. Absolutely. We have to remember sometimes. I apologize, didn't remember our audience. I'll happily add that. And I'll also add the guidance that was made available publicly.
All right. Thank you very much.
And I'll make sure that gets sent out post-call for everyone. So, Helen, we want to thank you so much and for extensive presentation and all the work you guys are doing at CPS. So thank you.
Thank you.
Our next presentation will come from Dr. Barbara Bazron, who serves as the director of the Department of Behavioral Health here in Washington, D.C. Dr. Bazron will discuss the district's 24-hour parent and family support line and self-care for parents initiative. So with that, I will turn the call over to Dr. Bazron. Dr. Bazron, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice, and the floor is yours. Dr. Bazron? Dr. Bazron, you hit the star button twice if you're with us. Okay, it looks like Dr. Bazron is not with us, so we'll move on in the presentation order. So with that, I'd like to introduce Emily Skiro, who serves as the Program Manager of Public Education and Awareness at Mental Health America. Emily will be discussing MHA's Back to School Toolkit.
Hello. Yes, I'm sorry. I somehow got on mute. My apologies.
Okay. Go right ahead, Dr. Bazron.
Okay. All right. First of all, what I was saying is that I'm really delighted to be a part of this panel
I, in addition to being the director of the Department of Behavioral Health, I'm a former building principal. And so, you know, schools are very important to me. The parents in the District of Columbia, like almost everyone else, I'm sure, around the country, are experiencing high levels of stress as they seek to manage the demands of parenting responsibility, of work, of distance learning, and the impact of being sequestered for many months with their family members. What we learned from parents prior to the beginning of the school year is that they were very concerned regarding the fact that their children were going to be returning to school, and they were going to be in a position where, of course, they had to support learning. And for those of us who are educators, that's one experience. If you're a parent and you haven't had to do that, then it's totally something else. So the parents said that they really needed tools and resources and support for their own mental health and mental well-being, as well as that of their family members. And so as a result, the District of Columbia Parent Support Program was developed. One of the things that I want to share with you before I talk about the program is that the District of Columbia, which has about 700,000 residents, like a lot of communities, has suffered a real financial drain and financial deficit as a result of the pandemic. And as a result, there was no new money to begin this type of effort. And so we had to really build on existing resources. So we had to survey what we had and figure out what we needed to do as we moved forward. So we looked at how we might be able to redirect some of our existing resources. So we built this program based upon the district school-based behavioral health program, where we have clinicians physically located within our public schools and public charter schools who provide prevention, intervention, and treatment services on an ongoing basis to the children that attend those particular schools. We also have Healthy Futures, which is an early childhood consultation effort where we provide consultation services and support to early childhood centers throughout the District of Columbia. And we do childhood observations and provide consultation to the adults who are responsible for the young people within that environment. So what you see on the slide is based upon utilizing existing resources. I've put together a slide deck, and I am now going to move through the slide deck. So if you turn to the slide deck number 3, I want to share with you what our guidelines were for creating this parent support program as we began to think it through. One, we needed it to be convenient, because parents are busy and now they have additional responsibilities related to their child's education. It had to be easy to access. We wanted it to be available 24/7 for parents so that when they have a quiet moment, they could get the support that they need. And it needed to address the needs of parents with children from early childhood all the way up through through high school ages. And it needed to focus on the mental well-being of both the parents as well as the children and other members of the family. That was the framework that we used as we began to think through the component parts. On the next slide, you will see that one of the things that we made available was a 24/7 mental health hotline. This goes through our Access Helpline service. We actually started the mental health helpline back in March at the beginning of the pandemic. It is available 24/7. We have licensed clinicians who answer these phones, and any person within the district can call this number, and they can get immediate and specific support around stress and anxiety that they may have. One of the things that I might share with you is that what our experience has been is that people have been calling the hotline when they're experiencing stress related to things other than simply school. We have been able to connect families to other available community supports, such as those families who are food challenged, to food resources, to housing resources for individuals who are unhoused, to legal supports in instances of any kind of intrafamilial abuse, as well as employment benefits. So our clinicians do know what resources are available. And here again, this hotline is answered immediately within only a couple of rings. On the next slide, you will see also that we know that some parents need more than just a one-shot phone call to a mental health hotline. However, we know that there's great stigma around mental health. People do not want to admit to the need of mental health services and are reluctant to enter mental health services. So we needed to create a low barrier way for individuals to get the one-to-one support that they needed. So any parent can call the line. They can get up to 3 visits with a clinician for one-to-one support to address trauma, grief, and loss. We have many families who actually within the district have lost family members. They can also get information around behavior management issues that they're facing with their young people, as well as information about self-care to deal with some of their own issues that they're facing. And also, we can connect them after the 3 visits to ongoing services and supports within our community provider network. One of the big things, and one of, I think, the real positive features of this program has been that our mayor, Mayor Muriel Bowser, actually asked me to join her in one of her press conferences to really begin to push this out and make this known. And Mayor Bowser, indicated her support for everyone to get the mental wellness supports that they need, and that's made also a big difference. In addition to the one-to-one and the services through our mental wellness hotline, we also have something that's very popular called Wellness Wednesdays, which was launched a few weeks ago. This is literally an online parental support group where we have licensed clinicians talk about a variety of topics. The topics that they address are based upon the Parent Cafe model, which includes topics related to resilience, relationships, knowledge development, support, and communication. And these have been everything from doing a mindfulness session online to talking about some of the issues that everyone is facing, having opportunity for that communication among and between the people who are there. It happens every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., and it is also available on our website so that if somebody misses the session, they can go to our website at dbh.dc.gov, and they can play back the session. So I think that that's been an extremely popular item. I have attended some of them myself, and I have to tell you, I picked up some real tips that have really helped me mind my own mental health as we have gone through the pandemic. The other thing that we are building, we have available, but we are still building out, is our online library, which has a variety of tools that can be accessed at any time of the day or night, and that is and is resident on our DBH website. The focus of these tools is for parents to have tips on how to take care of their own mental wellness, parenting strategies, and also how to manage distance learning and, of course, social-emotional learning while their children are functioning within a distance learning modality. And I might tell you that currently for the first semester, the young people within in the District of Columbia are all receiving their instruction virtually. For second semester, which begins November 9th, they will go to a hybrid model. And so, you know, we also will be adjusting to make sure that we have additional services and supports. Our public schools have developed Parent University that also is a resource to help them with online learning, as well as how to schedule and function within a hybrid model as that comes up. And then we offer weekly parent tips in our online library. Next slide, you will see that here again, as I said earlier, we are linking parents and families and our teachers with the school-based clinicians that are a part of our school-based behavioral health team. The clinicians have the opportunity to join the classrooms virtually as virtual instruction is going on. They provide support in terms of social-emotional learning, and they also do observations, classroom observations, to identify any young people who might need additional support, and then to do the follow-up with those families to make sure they get the support that they need. I might add that the school-based clinicians can provide services through telehealth, and that is individualized mental health services and supports for families and or for children. So we have linked those services together. And then lastly, I just wanted to give you some sense of some of the virtual student resources we have. We know our young people are very savvy in terms of using their computers and using social media and so forth. And so we also have compiled a list of student resources for them. So that gives you a brief and quick overview of our efforts. We have gotten very positive feedback, and here again, this is an instance of using what you have and being nimble so that we can provide the services and supports that our residents require. With that, I will open it up and turn it back to you for any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Bazaron. And if you have a question for Dr. Bazaron, you could unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Dr. Bazaron, I actually want to get on that last point you just made. If you are giving advice to jurisdictions similar to what you guys did, where you guys took an inventory of what you guys had and built around that, especially in the current budget climates that we're operating under and will likely operate under for some time, what advice would you have for them?
First of all, We listen to parents to say, what are your needs, as opposed to guessing what their needs were. There are a number of public forums that all of us are using right now. So that's number one. Number two, if you have school-based behavioral health services within your jurisdictions, and those services are available across the country, I really suggest that you figure out how to incorporate those services within the virtual environment and how to tailor the topics to meet the needs of parents. The other thing that we have is most of us have hotlines, either a crisis hotline or of one type or another. We can also modify those lines very easily for no cost, so that they can, or the cost is very nominal, to support the needs of our families. I find that there are a lot of resources that we have, and we just have to kind of think through how we can better utilize them within our new normal, which is the COVID environment.
Great. Anyone have a question for Dr. Basra? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. I'll pause here for a second.
And if not, I would just ask all of us to mind our mental health, because we too are affected by the stressors related to the current pandemic, and we are the worst at taking care of ourselves, and so I just encourage you to do so.
Well, those are great words to end on there, and Dr. Basra, I really appreciate your presentation and all the great work you guys are doing in the district.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to our final presentation of the afternoon. Sort of went into it a little while ago, but I want to introduce Emily Scale, who serves as the Program Manager of Public Education and Awareness at Mental Health America. Emily will be discussing MHA's Back to School Toolkit. Mental Health America releases an annual Back to School Toolkit to support school personnel, parents, and students' mental well-being during the return to school. This year's toolkit is themed Coping During COVID and addresses the loneliness, grief, and anxiety that many are feeling as we navigate the uncharted waters of COVID-19. The 2020 toolkit includes resources on recognizing mental health concerns in kids and teens, how teachers can protect their own mental health, handling the challenges of remote learning as a parent, and how kids can cope with change and worry. It is available for download for free at www.mhanational.org/back-to-school, and I'll make sure to include that in the follow-up email so you can download it as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Emily. Emily, if you unmute your line, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Walt. Glad to join you, everyone. So first, I want to give you some background on Mental Health America so y'all know who we are. MHA has been around since 1909. We are a national community-based nonprofit based out of Alexandria, Virginia, so just outside of D.C., and we focus on promoting mental health as a critical part of overall wellness for everyone. So we advocate for prevention services like SEL programs in schools, early identification and intervention for people at risk, integrated care and support for those who need them, and focus on recovery as the end goal. So in the national office where I work, we do a lot of policy work, education and awareness campaigns, and research. And then we have over 200 affiliates across the country who provide more direct services. So as part of our public education and awareness work, we release a number of toolkits each year for things like Mental Health Month in May, BIPOC Mental Health Month in July, and of course, Back to School. So our Back to School toolkit this year is themed Coping During COVID. We know that back to school can be a tough time during normal circumstances. Transitions are hard for most people, and especially for kids. And we all know that this year, everyone is dealing with even more uncertainty. So kids are lonely and confused and scared. Families are overwhelmed with remote learning. Teachers are trying to adapt on the fly with little guidance. It's a pretty chaotic time for everyone. We wanted to create a comprehensive, bundled resource for anyone navigating the back to school transition. Our toolkit is more than just mental health information, so it's focused on outreach so that you can promote mental health awareness and provide resources in your individual communities. It includes things like fact sheets, example social media posts, including language and graphics, and newsletter inserts. To give you a better idea of the content included, I'll walk y'all through the framework of it. So So we have a one-pager on key messages, which goes over the main things to keep in mind about mental health as we go back to school during a pandemic. And then there's a general COVID and mental health drop-in article that can be included in a student newsletter, family newsletter, sent out as an e-blast. It's really meant for you to take this content, these resources, and use them how is best fit in your community. And then we also have a long list of other resources divided by population. So we have tools for everyone, for teachers and school admin, for parents, and for students. Then in terms of our main fact sheets and articles, our topics for kids and teens are how to maintain your social relationships during online school, missing how things used to be and tips on coping with change, and what can I do when I'm afraid, which discusses what fear is and how kids can help themselves feel less distressed. For parents and teachers, we have dealing with potential exposure and the stress of physically reopening schools, how teachers and parents can work together to make distance learning effective, how teachers can protect their own mental health, which is really, really important right now because there's a lot riding on our teachers, how parents can cope with the stress of remote learning, especially when students are really young and need that consistent adult reinforcement, even when adults are maybe working from home or trying to get other things done around the house. And then knowing the signs of mental health concerns in kids and teens. That's something we're really focused on right now. I mentioned that one of the main parts of our mission is prevention and early intervention. So it's easy and common to dismiss mental health systems in young children as just kids being kids. But a lot of kids are really struggling, and mental health challenges can very easily mask as misbehavior, lack of focus, a lot of things that teachers see daily when they're in the classroom, which is why this year is really tricky with that, because sometimes students, there's all sorts of different models going on around the country. Some places are fully remote, some places are hybrid learning with half the class in at a time. So teachers don't necessarily have their eyes on their students as much as they're used to. So it's important that students are able to recognize certain behaviors as potential mental health concerns, especially because these rates will likely be higher than in past years, as many families and kids have faced traumatic circumstances over the last few months. And even if they haven't necessarily, just living through a pandemic is causing a lot of trauma for a lot of people, and especially younger kids who don't fully understand what's going on. And then B, we want parents to be able to pick up on these things. So they may not have seen these behaviors in their kids before if it only flares up at school. So that's our 2020 toolkit, and it's available for immediate download for free at mhanational.org/back-to-school. And I do want to point y'all towards some related resources as well. So most of our toolkits, especially this year, especially this specific toolkit, are based on the data we get from people who take a mental health screen on our screening site. So we currently have 10 screens available on mhascreening.org. They're the exact same questionnaires you'd get in a doctor's office. They're free, quick, confidential, anonymous. And after completing, people are linked to resources based on their results. Most of these screens are condition specific, like the depression test or the anxiety test. But I want to especially highlight the youth test and the parent test. So these both consist of the pediatric symptom checklist. And the parent test is especially great for adults who may be concerned about a child in their life, but aren't totally sure where to start. So it can help you to determine if a child's emotions, their attention, their behaviors might be signs of a mental health problem. And then at that same link for this year's Back to School Toolkit, you can find our toolkits from past years. So our 2019 toolkit is focused on stress and loneliness in children and teens. So while it's not COVID specific, it's obviously still pretty relevant, and I would definitely encourage you to check that out as well. So with that, I think that's a pretty solid general overview. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Emily. Like I said, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. If you have any questions for Emily on the toolkit, I'll just pause right there for a second. Emily, one question that we actually got submitted via the registration form, and I think this actually is most appropriate for you, is how do you suggest approaching hesitation from families about sending their students back to school?
Yeah, so that's a tricky one. It really is an independent decision. Each family is different. Each person's comfort level is different right now, and I think that's kind of the general approach with all things COVID-related right now, is doing what feels best for you. We do talk about that a bit in this toolkit, and how it really does come down to making the decision that's best for you, your kids, your family, and not feeling guilty about that. Parents do know their kids better than anyone else, really. And it depends definitely on your school district, what your school district is doing. But it really is a matter of working with families. No one can be perfect right now. I think that's something that we all need to accept and all have accepted. And it comes down to teamwork, everyone working together. What can we do to make you feel more comfortable sending your kid in maybe half time? What can we do to make sure that when your kid is half time at home, that they're learning to the best of their ability and our ability?
Great. Last call for questions for Emily. Emily, could you just one more time say how you can access the toolkit?
Sure thing. mhanational.org/back to school.
Great. Well, Emily, thank you so much, and thanks for all the work you guys are doing at MHA, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. I want to thank all our speakers for taking the time out of their day to come present with us today. This call has been recorded, so I will send around that link tomorrow morning. So should you have any additional questions or want further information from anyone you heard from today, you can email me directly at wbishop, that's WBISHOP, at cityhall.nyc.gov. Our October call will take place on Tuesday, October 13th, from 2:15 to 3:15 Eastern, and we will talk to you all then. Good day, everybody.